This is the Tony D Show, brought to you by Quicken Loans. Take advantage of historic low rates. Go to Rocket Mortgage today.
Great moments are born from great opportunity.
Follow Tony on Twitter at Tony D Radio.
Guys, I'm bringing the party to you.
From the Quicken Loans Studios in New Jersey, here's your host, Tony Desiri.
All right, good Wednesday to you here on SB Nation Radio. I am Tony D. Our telephone number to join us today, and again, we've got a lot of previews to get to for this weekend's basketball games. We're going to talk about Gonzaga. We're going to talk about the Final Four. 800-777-2907. I do want to start the show with last night's Houston Rockets Golden State Warriors game. Yesterday, we did a little bit of a look inside the Rockets, and we looked inside this a Rockets team that's fun to watch. They're surging. They hit a lot of threes. They play. They're just a fun basketball team if you like that high style Mike D'Antoni way. But last night, they were cold from behind the arc. Last night, the Golden State Warriors defense limited their ability to shoot the three last night. They were 5 of 31, shooting 16% from behind the arc, and Golden State won the game 113-106. Actually, it was a little tighter than I thought it was going to be, because it was like 17-point lead at the end of the first quarter. But that's neither here nor there. These are regular season games. We can extrapolate a lot of information from them. But the thing that I wanted to get to was something that producer Joe George mentioned yesterday in Top 5, Bottom 5, and it had me thinking last night as I was watching the end of this game, which is, hey, the Golden State Warriors have now won 8 in a row, and they're looking like the Golden State Warriors we knew over the last 2 years, because they're doing it without Kevin Durant. Now, the idea is that you bring in Kevin Durant when he comes off injury, and then you plug him in, and now because the Golden State Warriors now know who they are, here comes Durant, boom, off they go towards the playoffs. But this is now a little bit of a concern for me, because it's not just inserting Kevin Durant and everything rolling. What the Golden State Warriors are looking like right now came because they needed to find who they were without Kevin Durant. All of the players that have sacrificed a little bit, the way the basketball team constructed itself with Durant in the lineup and their willingness to go into that direction had to be altered, and it took the Warriors some time. Now we're seeing a Warriors team that looks a lot like what we've seen before, minus some players, but nevertheless, the key contributors of this team of Draymond Green, Steph Curry, Klay Thompson, doing what they did last night. They combined for like 75 points in this game, in this win. Is Kevin Durant coming back on this team a concern? Or are we nitpicking because, in the end, we want that to be the case? We never really liked the idea of them unifying their powers at the back in July in the first place. Now, that's something I was kind of thinking about last night as I was kind of saying, okay, what can I take out of this game? And what I took out of it was, look, when the Rockets hit threes, they're a good basketball team. When they don't, as we learned yesterday, they struggle to win some games. It's not the thing that they do the best, but it's the big component that they do that matters. With Golden State, I wonder how this team will look when Durant comes back from injury. There's not going to be a ton of games to figure it out again. And while they're not going to be vulnerable in the first round, I don't care if it's Portland or Denver or whoever they play out of that 8 seed. And even if they were to stumble a bit and get the 2 seed, I don't see their first round. But as we get closer and closer to the real good competition in the West, I wonder if the addition of Durant and them trying to figure it out again is enough of a stumbling block to make a playoff series rather interesting. That's the only takeaway that I take out of this game, besides the fact that the Rockets, when they don't hit their threes, they struggle to win some games. All right, 800-777-2907, 800-777-2907. By the way, I'm going to give credit where credit is due. Joe mentioned that yesterday in our top five, bottom five, and that's what was in my brain last night. I was watching the last second half of that game last night.
Thanks, Tony. Nice, I appreciate that.
Nice sticking that little thought in my head.
And James Harden got that. We were talking about it yesterday, the 2000 points scoring and assists. He got that yesterday.
He did. So now the Rockets did not, and I said this yesterday because assuming that they would, they were 8 3-pointers away from tying the NBA record set by Golden State for most ever in a season. They only got 5, so we got to wait for them to accomplish that in the next game.
That's lame.
I thought they would have it by the second quarter.
Yeah, right.
Right, they would just be adding on to the record throughout the game tonight, but they only had 5. 16% from behind the arc. Most of that was Golden State, but a lot of it was just, clunk, clunk, clunk. You're going to have that. But again, that's my thought process as we head to the playoffs. By the way, the Denver Nuggets-Portland game last night, I know a lot of people weren't paying too much attention, but that's a battle for the eighth seed right now in the West, if you care about those kind of things. And Portland right now has an upper hand on Denver for that position, winning in that particular game. So they've got the one-game lead over Denver for that eighth and final playoff spot. All right, some NFL news that I want to get to as well. And this is an ongoing saga that gets more and more detailed and little nuggets of information that pop up, but it's become the same kind of story. And that is the Jerry Jones Tony Romo saga got a little interesting yesterday when Jerry Jones was asked about it and he said, well, there'll be some resolution by training camp, which makes people wonder where exactly is this going and how weird is it? Look, I don't know what the Dallas Cowboys want for Tony Romo. I don't know what they're asking for. I don't know what they're demanding. I do know this. No one is biting and no one is nibbling on the hook. All right. Whatever the Cowboys are dangling out there as a trade possibility, no one's biting. John Elway has said time and time again, he's not interested in Romo per se. He's very happy with where he stands. That is a typical GM answer. That is a typical answer you give when you're not going to give details of your conversations. And for the most part, I have to admit, John Elway is telling the truth in a way. He's not interested in training for Romo. If that's exactly what the Dallas Cowboys want to do, that's not where John Elway is going to go. If you want to bring in Romo as a free agent, if you want to negotiate with Romo on a free agent deal, that's fine. I'm sure the Broncos are interested, and I'm sure the Broncos will meet with Romo's people. But if you're just dangling it out there like, we'll take a couple of picks, or we'll take... No. We're not done. We're done. I think there is a little bit to the idea of the whole you do right by us, we'll do right by you situation that Romo and Jerry Jones are reportedly supposed to have. But I don't know exactly what that means. I mean, what exactly is Jerry Jones wanting out of the deal? Go to a non-contender? What, go to Cleveland? Play out your career with a team that has no chance of winning a Super Bowl? Or is it don't go to Houston? Or don't go to the Redskins or any other particular team in our division. I don't know of anybody in the division that would want Romo, but is it that kind of conversation? Is Denver okay, but Houston not? Because Houston winning a Super Bowl with you is worse for me than Denver winning a Super Bowl because they're both in the same conference. I don't know. But training camp? Now, what is Romo supposed to do from now until then? Is he a member of the Cowboys? Is he supposed to act like he's a member of the Cowboys? Is he supposed to show up and work out? What if he does? What if he gets hurt? If you're Romo, what do you do? Like, do you just wait? Do you assume the $14 million is now as a backup? Is Jerry Jones waiting out Romo's possible retirement? Maybe if I play this out long enough, Romo will realize that in the end, he doesn't want to go through this again. He doesn't want to go through this to be a backup. Maybe he'll retire, and then I don't have to worry about it. What's the play here for Dallas? Because they're certainly not doing the right thing by Romo. They're not doing what is, and that's their words, not mine. That's what's the most perplexing thing. It'd be one thing if we all were assuming that Jerry Jones would do right by Tony Romo because of their relationship and his affection for him. If it was on us, media, fans, and whatnot, if it was on us that said, well, he'll do the right thing. He'll do the right thing. If Jerry Jones and Stephen Jones say, no, we don't have to do the right thing. We can do whatever we want. We never said we would. But that's not what the situation is. The situation is that he said that they were going to do the right thing by Tony Romo. But what exactly is that? Boy, if I'm Romo, this is perplexing. And I'm sure there's some bitter blood now that's starting to brew. If you want to get on with that last part of that last chapter of a particular point in your life, and in this case, it's Romo being a 37-year-old quarterback playing out the next couple of years for somebody just to continue to play. Look, I got to admit, it's got to be frustrating for him because on the one hand, it's easy for us to go, oh, you've been injured, you've been hurt, just call it a career, go into broadcasting, you'll be good at it. But if you're Romo, do you want to look back on the last 2 years of your career and say, that's how I left it? That's how I'm going to leave the game? I'm not going to leave the game with Dez Bryant in Lambeau Field in a catch-no-catch situation against Green Bay in the playoffs. I'm not going to leave that. I'm leaving with 2 years where I got hurt and the team was awful. Then I got hurt again the next year and the team was fantastic. If I'm Romo, I can't live with that. I would want one more. If I get hurt a third year, all right, then I know the football gods are telling me to call it quits. But if I, but if I'm looking at the last 2 years and went, man, what a roller coaster. I was desperately needed 2 years ago when no backup on this team could win a game. And the whole city was waiting for me to return. Then I get hurt again, and the city doesn't want me around because the backup is playing really well, and he's a rookie, and he's making everybody nervous around the league. I would want one more grasp at this before I called it quits forever. And it doesn't look like the two parties are on the same page. All right, coming up, one more thing that the NFL did that I understand, but I hate. I'll tell you what it is next. I'm Tony D. It's SB Nation Radio.
This is the Tony D Show on SB Nation Radio. Here's your host, Tony DeZiri.
All right, glad you could be with us here on SB Nation Radio. Pete Woodburn is going to join us from SB Nation 15 minutes from now, talking about Gonzaga, a program that has transitioned from Cinderella to power with no hardware, to now a Final Four team. It's been a while. It's 1999 all the way through the 2000s. They emerged from this Cinderella program that, you know, everybody was kind of excited about, kind of the typical Cinderella enthusiasm that you get when they get into an Elite Eight. And then they've transferred from that into a really good program, but yet a really good program that never went to a Final Four. So they transferred from everybody's darling to everybody wondering what was wrong to now making it finally to a Final Four. So we'll take a look at the Gonzaga Bulldogs. They'll go up against South Carolina coming up on Saturday in Glendale. All right, this next story is one of those that I get all the time, which is I get it, but I hate it. Which is, I understand why we're doing this. I understand the rationale why we're doing this, but I don't particularly like it. And look, there are two ways to take a story like this and look at it. One, you can say you're being too old, or you're being too, you know, you're too old school, or you can you could have embraced something and have it taken away, and that's what this is. The NFL owners have banned players from leaping over the line of scrimmage to block kicks, extra points, and field goals. All right, Bobby Wagner, who has done this many times, will now no longer be able to do it. That perfectly timed guy that can leap over the line and attempt to block a kick, the NFL said, no, we're done. Now, I don't like this because I think the play is massively entertaining, and I love it, and I would love my team to have a player like this that can do this. It makes field goals, those last-second field goals, really interesting when you know on the other side is a player that has potentially the capability of to leap up and block this kick. All right. And with the extra points being pulled back, this is an added element of joy for me when I watch it. Why are they banning this? Well, they're banning this for a couple of reasons. And one is safety, right? Player safety. They're actually worried that down the road that somebody will go all nuclear on them and say, yeah, all those leaps when I landed on my shoulder and my head and my neck did all this kind of damage, and you guys did nothing to stop it, knowing that there was a potential to do this. This is a real slippery slope. By the way, this is a real slippery slope. But they're doing it because there are two factions to this. One, it's safety for the leaper, and it's safety for the people that are going to prevent the leaper, the two-way side. In order to defend that, if you're a player, in order to coach a way to defend the guy leaping, you put both players, the guy that is going to have to stand up and try to prevent the leaper from making the block, and the leaper itself, you put them at grave danger, right? One could fall on the other, they could knock on their heads, they could fall on their necks, all sorts of things. So this is like preventative medicine. Do I get it? Yeah, I get it. The NFL is basically saying, well, we don't want this conversation 5-6 years from now. And we don't want to be looked at when we have people on our safety board saying, hey, this is one play, if I were you guys, I'd ban. And that's what they're getting. They're getting information from people to say, yeah, if it was me, I'd ban this. And so the owner said, well, of course, we have a business, we want to protect the business, and now we're done. I hate it. There's something about this that I'm going to really, really miss. And I know the immediate reaction is to go down the no fun league. I get that. And I know the immediate reaction for me is to say, man, they're taking a little bit of the game out of the game. I get why they're doing it. I just hate that they're doing it. I hate this part because I enjoy this play. When it comes to celebrations, for example, right? Like when they want to crack down on celebrations, that's when you can attack the no fun league, because the theory behind it is the NFL looks at celebrations in a number of ways. One, on the taunting angle to it. One, sort of a delay of game aspect to it. But I've always believed that the reason that the NFL has gone nuts on celebrations is that they don't want the players to have a platform to do something that they can trademark, sell shirts, all that other stuff. Kind of like the Icky Shuffle back in the day, or the Gastineau Sack Dance, or the Fun Bunch of the Redskins. I think they said, look, we don't want our game to be used by 22 different players on the field as a venue for some sort of secondary identity market. And we don't need it. We don't. If you score a touchdown and you do a 12-part orchestrated choreographed dance, then I've got to let the guy that makes the sack do the 12-act choreographed dance, and then the guy that makes a 2-yard tackle do the same thing, or the running back that gets the first down the same thing, or the wide receiver that gets caught, makes a catch in a double team the same thing. And next thing I know, my game takes 14 and a half hours. Right, I've got to have some measurable control. And in that case, we can argue the plus and minuses of creativity, and we can argue plus or minuses of the no fun league angle. But on this, they're claiming safety, and I'm saying, well, I'm going to really miss it. I'm going to miss the leaps. I thought they were great. I mean, I was great. So I'm kind of sad to see this go. But again, I get what the NFL is trying to do. Look, if you're the NFL, and you're investing so much money to your talent on the field, right? And then you get labeled and slapped and beaten up about safety. And you get told you don't care about safety. Like, you're going into court and you're telling people who've suffered injuries, life-changing injuries from your game, and you're saying, oh, there's nothing to see here. And then when evidence comes up about concussions, about CTE, you go, oh, there's nothing to see here. And then you create a rule like on the quarterbacks and the helmet, the hits to the helmet and things. And we think more or less that you're just protecting investment than you are really caring about the safety on the field. I've always said once the NFL started making PAs, PSAs for its safety, I knew the league was going down a different way. I mean, think about it. No other sport had public service commercials that talked about the safety of the game. Remember the one where Tom Brady was talking to the mother about all the research that they were doing on helmet safety and whatnot? The NFL was doing that. They were looking down the pipeline and saying, hey, if we don't present a unified force on safety, we're going to lose people. We're going to lose moms. And if we lose moms, we're in big trouble for the future of the game. And so they really were making this big push. We care about safety. We care about safety. We care about safety. And in this case, they're like literally standing on a box going, we care about safety. We're taking this play away. We know it's fun. We know there's something to this that is enjoyable for the fans, but we're going to ban it. And the reason we're going to ban it is we don't want a guy landing on his neck. We don't want a guy landing on his head. We don't want the play that gets properly defended, meaning that some guy's going to get hurt. And we do not want to hear about this 5 or 6 years later when that individual is really hurt. And we could have done something and we didn't. But at the same time, is it okay for me to completely understand that and be on the other side of the coin and go, I still am going to miss it. I'm still going to miss it. I remember hearing about all these. I remember having this debate with people all the time back when they were trying to protect the quarterback. They make all these rules. And I remember my friends going, a sack is just going to be ripping a flag off a guy now. That's what it's going to be. The quarterback's going to stand in the pocket, and he got to take the flag off of his belt, and that's going to be a sack. They're not even going to let you touch the quarterback anymore. I said, I don't think it's ever going to get to that. But I have to admit, I don't want to see 15 backups, making them push towards the playoffs. If you can tweak the rules a little bit, and I get to see the star quarterbacks in the postseason instead of their backups, then I'm cool with that. I'm okay with that if you want to do a little bit that way. If you're paying a guy $20-something million, you might want to make sure he actually works. But on this one, I think I'm going to miss the leap. Coming up, Gonzaga, from Cinderella to now Final Four. It's been a long journey for Mark Few. What does this Gonzaga team have this weekend? Not only against South Carolina, but possibly in the championship round. What are they all about? That's coming up next. I'm Tony D. Hit me up on Twitter at Tony D Radio or 800-777-2907. This is SB Nation Radio.
You're listening to SB Nation Radio. This is the Tony D Show.
All right, as we continue to take a look at the teams that are heading to Arizona for the Final Four, we are now time to preview the Gonzaga Bulldogs. Peter Woodburn joins us from SB Nation, covers the Zags, to give us an indication of what this team is going through as they head over to the Final Four. How are you, Peter?
I'm doing well. How are you?
What does this win, what is this meant for a program that went from Cinderella to, are they ever going to make a Final Four, to now making the Final Four? What has it been like in this week with sort of the monkey off their back?
You know, I mean, it's been pretty unspeakable. I think that everyone in the university, every fan could not be any more excited. You know, it's been, it was 1999 with that initial Elite Eight run, and where they seem so close to making the Final Four, you don't just trip and fall your way in, and it is difficult to make it in. And so to have it be this long, but to finally be able to make it onto the biggest stage, I mean, it's just been a total blast. I think the student seats, for the students, they sold those out in about 2 minutes. I think there's a majority of the students are probably going to make the roughly 20-hour drive from Spokane to Phoenix down there. And I don't think, you know, I think everyone is just as ecstatic as they can be. It's just kind of, it is without a doubt probably the most exciting thing that's happened in this program.
Before we get to this team and the game against South Carolina and their run here, I kind of like the large picture of Gonzaga. So you mentioned the 99 team, and that's when everybody started noticing, hey, this is a really, like, where is Gonzaga? Where is it on a map? What are they all about? Didn't John Stockton go there? And now it's turned into this kind of power that's been around, that's been in our lives as college basketball fans for years and years. How did they not go off the map? How did they not become one of the darlings we never hear from again? But how did they go from Cinderella to, yeah, and you'll be hearing about us every single year for a while?
You know, they had, it's really interesting. I think that one of the big things with the school that they were able, even though after, in 1999, Dan Monson, he was the head coach, and then he left after the 99 season, and then Mark Few was the assistant coach and took over. And the consistency between having Mark Few as the head coach and also having the same athletic director throughout the entire tenure, I think, has been really one of the keys that has kept it all together, because Mark Few has been able to build the program in his vision. And a lot of the times, that's never been going after the very best recruit in the nation. That's been going after the recruit that fits best into Gonzaga. And I think through that mindset, that's how they've always been able to maintain a presence on the national stage, because oftentimes, especially you look at a lot of those earlier Gonzaga teams, they were usually overperforming their seed. I mean, even if you look at last year's Sweet 16 run, the Zags are really good, but you know, no one was expecting them to make the Sweet 16 really last year, at least in Spokane. And I think that that's really kind of been one of the biggest things, is a lot of the times in these schools, or, you know, mid-major, especially when a mid-major team gets big or a mid-major team gets hot, the coach gets plucked right out of there. And I think with Mark Few enjoying his life in Spokane and sticking around, that's really been something that's been the major difference with Gonzaga and a lot of the other programs that have kind of risen up a little bit and tried to replicate their success.
There's a lot of people who don't see Gonzaga on a regular basis because they're on very late, and a lot of people aren't familiar with the conference that they play in and the teams that are in that conference. But I want to go back to the Sweet 16 matchup with West Virginia. This is a game that had 51 fouls. It was kind of the West Virginia nitty-gritty grind-out game. Did Gonzaga play any opponent that had that kind of outcome where you kind of get dragged down and you're kind of playing every basket? And what did we learn about Gonzaga coming out of a game like that?
You know, I think that this year in the West Coast Conference, it's a lot more, I mean, it's a smaller conference, and oftentimes it's a lot more of just a freewheeling offensive style that a lot of the teams play out there. A lot of good guards come out of the conference, a lot of good shooters and everything. And so the Zags never really have a lot of those grind them out defensive matchups. They have teams in the WCC that like to play at slower paces, but nothing on board with the physicality of what West Virginia brings. And so I think what we saw there was one of the big differences between this Gonzaga team and previous teams is that they have a huge focus on defense. And I think that people kind of heard, yeah, Gonzaga's good defensively. But they held West Virginia to only about 25% shooting. And granted, it was a grind out game that they barely won. But at the same time, I think that it showed that Gonzaga's defense can hold up with that more physical play that you see on a lot of the, you know, in a lot of the power conferences that oftentimes you don't see in the smaller mid-major conferences.
And then coming out of that game and then going and roughing up Xavier like they did, is that kind of the more freer Gonzaga offense that we've seen all season?
Yeah, you know, the Xavier game, I think, is exactly kind of more the Gonzaga on both ends of the floor that we've seen all season. They were great offensively, and they're hitting their outside shots, and then they were able to also do a lot of damage down low. And on the defensive end, you know, Xavier tried, but Xavier could not just get anything going. And so that's what makes Gonzaga really dangerous. I mean, Xavier was playing, you know, just as good as anyone else. You don't accidentally fall into the Elite Eight. And I mean, Gonzaga made Xavier look more than mortal. And so I think that if Gonzaga is playing like that, and that indication is kind of where everyone's saying, well, maybe this is a team that can definitely win the national title.
All right, when you look at this matchup with South Carolina coming up in the Final Four, South Carolina's defense has been smothering. They've been limiting. I mean, all the adjectives that you described to be a good defensive team, South Carolina's been labeled it. What do you see in the Gamecocks defensively, and do you see any signs of trouble for Gonzaga against that team?
You know, South Carolina's defense is, as you said, it's been absolutely stellar this entire tournament, and they've shut down some really, really good offenses along the way. So I think that we're going to see just another just cutthroat defensive battle between the two teams, and it's really just going to be whoever is able to knock down the shots that they need to. And so I think, you know, Gonzaga has the offense to be able to do that. Overall, this tournament, their offense hasn't really been shooting as well as it has throughout most of the season. The Xavier game was kind of the outlier, but in the first three games, some of the big players that you would expect to hit shots, Nigel Williams, Goss, Josh Perkins, you know, they weren't really hitting a lot of things. And so if Nigel Williams, Goss is able to continue his increased play off of the Xavier game, and I think that Gonzaga should be able to pull the game out, but it's not going to be easy because South Carolina's defense is really, really hard to push through. They make you take really poor shots. And so Gonzaga is just going to have to play smart basketball and see if they can just eke out enough offense to make it past them.
South Carolina has Sindarius Thornwell. If he's not in the game or he's limited in the game, that's it. South Carolina is not going to win. Is there a Gonzaga equivalent to that, or is this such a balanced team that it doesn't matter if Williams-Goss has a bad night or Karnowski has a bad night, that they can find answers?
Yeah, you know, for the Zags, they have, you know, Williams-Goss is the major player on the team. He's the guy that carries the team. But at the beginning of the year, I think through the first five games of the season, Gonzaga had a different person leading the team in scoring. They were the only team in all of college to have that happening. And this is an incredibly balanced squad. So it's really hard to just shut one person down and have the rest of the offense not be able to click. And in the front court end, you know, if Karnowski has a bad game, he's had a couple, you know, in the first two games of the tournament, Karnowski played less minutes than the 7-foot freshman, Zach Collins, and they play completely different styles. And so Mark Few has the options of players to turn to if someone is struggling or if someone's limited by foul trouble. And that's going to be really hard for South Carolina to cope with.
Peter Woodburn, again, SB Nation, covers Gonzaga as they head to Phoenix for the Final Four against South Carolina coming up on Saturday. Great stuff as always, my friend. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
You got it. All right. So that's, again, that's kind of, to me, the key in this game is that Gonzaga does get offensive efficiency from so many different places that if one struggles, the other guys pick him up. I don't think South Carolina is capable of doing that. They've got two great players in Sindarius Thornwell and PJ Dozier, but Sindarius Thornwell isn't playing well, it's a long night for South Carolina. That's it. But Williams, Nigel Goss, he doesn't necessarily have to play great, right? Karnowski doesn't necessarily have to play great, or anybody else on that Gonzaga team. There's other ways to pick it up. This is going to be an interesting challenge for South Carolina to go up against a team that can beat you with guard play, that can beat you with size. They beat you on the defensive end because they are a very, very good defensive team. And boy, they are offensively efficient. And we are starting to see that in this tournament in the different styles of games that they've played. Coming up next, big deal, little deal, no deal on a pressing issue for Adam Silver. We'll dissect something that he said. Coming up next, I'm Tony D. It's SB Nation Radio.
It's time to play big deal, little deal, no deal on the Tony D Show.
All right, I want to say, Joe, are you still surviving Tornado Watch 2017?
Yeah, it's totally clear now.
It's are you not in the eye of a storm? You're in clearance?
No, we might be in the eye, because isn't it in the eye where it's not as
crazy?
Is
that a hurricane? I'm sorry. I don't know. I don't know my natural disasters like I should.
I don't know.
I might have just made something up.
Yeah, no, that's a hurricane. But it quickly was just a little drizzle to look like the world was ending, the day after tomorrow, that movie.
Oh, yeah,
I
absolutely.
Was like, oh, I'm going to die. Oh, I'm going to die. And I didn't die. And we stayed on the air, which is awesome.
I lived in Tennessee for 5 years, and I loved Tennessee. I thought it was pretty. It was a nice place to live. Great barbecue. Great all that good stuff. Great music. But the tornado warnings were nerve-wracking.
Yeah, I remember that from Southern Illinois. It's very similar.
It's just – and because you don't know what – I mean, we would stick the kids in the closet, and I'm like, we're not going to survive this if a tornado lands in my town and smashes through my area here. This little closet isn't going to keep us safe, and it can be very, very scary. So I'm glad you're still kicking around. All right, so I want to get to Big Deal, Little Deal, No Deal. Adam Silver has said that a women's NBA coach is coming sooner than later. That's a very vague term, by the way. We have no idea what he means, but this seems to... Here's where I want to go with this on Big Deal, Little Deal, No Deal. If an NBA team hires a woman head coach, that's fine with me. I'm not saying that can't work. I'm not going to go down the road of saying that's ridiculous. But if Adam Silver is pushing this, is that a Big Deal, Little Deal, No Deal? If he's pressuring or subtly pressuring his league to come in compliance with this quickly within a 5-year plan or a 6-year plan, Big Deal, Little Deal, No Deal?
You know, I think it's a big deal. Because if I'm Adam Silver, and this is important to me, I look at Seattle, I look at Las Vegas, I want to expand, and I say, what a perfect time to add a female coach and just attach her to an expansion team to make it happen. So if he wants to make it happen, I think he can. He can't force an organization that he doesn't control to make it happen. But he can tell an ownership group in Seattle to say, hey, you're going to hire Nancy Lieberman as your first coach. And if it doesn't work out, that's fine. But you are going to hire her first. And if you do that, you get a new franchise. You get the Sonics back. So I think it is a big deal. Because if he wants to make it happen, he's going to find a way.
He's going to find a way. I'm really curious as to where this going 5 or 6. Now, I have a daughter who loves basketball. So I would actually like to see this. I'd like to see this in place at some point. I worry, though, about the internal pressure that the league may generate on guys who own teams saying, you got to do this. And one team saying, wait a minute. We really do want the best person available, regardless of gender. We do need the best possible head coach. And if that leans towards being a male, that leans towards being a male. I will say this. There was a bit of news that I think got underlooked over the last, with all the stuff that we've been having fed to us about the Raiders and college basketball. It was that the University of Florida had an opening for its women's head coaching position, and they interviewed Becky Hammon, and she turned it down and pulled herself out because she wants to stay in the NBA and continue on that pursuit of being an NBA head coach. She didn't want to have to go back to the women's college basketball game because she's thinking, I'm in a better position on Popovich's staff to make this dream happen than going down the college route. If I go down to the college route, well, now I'm in a pool of a lot of really good women coaches across the country. But if I'm one of the only few female coaches in the league, and Nancy Lieberman is another example of that, if I'm in the NBA, if my checks are from an NBA team, then I'm better off here, even if I'm not a head coach, even if I don't run the program. The pipeline to get to where I want to go is shorter here than it is ever going to be back at Florida, where if you're looking for a female head coach in the NBA, you are looking across the country, across all the women's college basketball coaches, but very few have actually got themselves in the NBA right now. And Becky Hammon does. So I thought that was a good career move on her part. The money might have been better at Florida than it is with the Spurs and what she's doing with the Spurs. The responsibilities are better at Florida than what she's doing with the Spurs. But if she's looking long term, she's exactly where she needs to be.
Yeah, without a doubt. I totally agree. It's the right move for sure. And because you look at the success, and if you're going to go to the women's college ranks, I mean, even though it's against what Adam Silver says, you're still going to hire Geno before you hire anyone
else.
He's still the first call. If someone's going to make a jump from women's college basketball, which is significantly slower, a significantly different game, they're going to go call Geno first, and then they're going to go to Becky Hammon if she goes to Florida. So she's definitely making the right move, staying in San Antonio. And who knows, maybe she'll just replace Pop. It wouldn't shock me.
It wouldn't, and Pop wouldn't mind that one bit, I bet you, if that day ever happens. He'd probably vouch for her. The thing about this is interesting is that I look at it from a commissioner's standpoint. I think he has to be a little careful in terms of saying sooner than later without a specific idea of what that means. What if that's 25 years from now? Look, Joe, I think we both agree that if we looked ahead 25 years and saw a league that never had a female head coach, would we be really surprised?
No, not at all.
Not at all. Not at all. If 25 years from now, when I'm in the old folks' home and this doesn't ever happen, I would not be shocked at all. The way he sets this up, it almost sounds like it's going to happen within a 5-year period. And that's just me putting some sort of, you know, putting a little time frame on a very vague terminology. But saying sooner rather than later, you can get away with anything with that phrase. You can say that all the time. You can say that about anything. Oh, it's happening sooner rather than later. Well, what does sooner mean? Well, I don't know. Sooner rather than later. Well, yeah, that's by definition of anything. Right. If I go on vacation in 2 weeks rather than 5 weeks, it comes sooner rather than later.
Yeah.
Tomorrow comes sooner rather than later.
Yeah,
right.
Sure.
It's a generic term that doesn't really have any weight. What does he really mean? Is he talking to people about this? Does he have a feeling that there are teams willing to go down this road? Again, you're right about Greg Popovich. If the day ever comes and he decides to quit, would he vouch for Becky Hammon? I think he'd vouch for Becky Hammon right now to take a head coaching job anywhere in the NBA tomorrow.
Yeah, because sooner rather than later for Pop might be in like 10 years.
Might be 10 years. Exactly. The commissioner, Adam Silver. All right, coming up next, we'll get more into the NBA. The Raiders situation is now really, really messy as we sort of dissect what this move to Vegas could mean. And Colin Kaepernick, is he being blackballed across the NFL? I've got some information to make you think otherwise. I'm Tony D. It's SB Nation Radio.